Testing 123 West Courtroom, April 30.
This panel, I'm honored to be completing the sitting with Judge Higginbotham and Judge Elrod. You all are veterans of this forum, so you know all the rules, although I find it helpful to remind. The main admonition is that when you get that amber light, it's just a good idea to see if there's some other points that you might need to make. We've had this week some people who got down to that yellow light and they still had 9 more points to make, and it just kind of doesn't work in 2 minutes. So with that, though, if you get a red light and we're asking you questions, the value of oral argument is to help the panel. So by all means, answer the questions. And other than that, just stay in the microphone so we can hear you well, and we'll all do good. All right, first case up. United States versus Harold Rosbottom Jr. and Ashley Kisler. Ms. Adelson? Adelson, I'm sorry.
Okay, good. Yeah. Okay.
Good. You're good.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm going to focus mostly on point ones, just so you know beforehand. An employee of a state or local police department cannot sit on a federal jury even if he or she wants to. That is an absolute prohibition. It's codified by statute, and it has been actually since 1948 at least. It's part of the Western District of Louisiana jury plan, which this court has approved. And a district court has no discretion to refuse a for cause challenge if the defense says this juror is disqualified under the statute. And it matters if a district court fails to comply with the statute. It is a matter of consequence. There is an institutional interest in making sure that district courts comply with this statute. Congress carefully crafted the Jury Selection and Service Act to eliminate disqualifications based upon selective criteria. And to that end, it specified objective criteria for jurors who are exempt or disqualified. The district court has no authority to disregard that mandate. And if the issue comes before this court, with all due respect, this court must correct an error of law. And of course, it matters to the criminal defendant, who has a limited number of peremptories and is entitled to a qualified jury and should not be required to use one of his peremptories to ensure that he gets what he's statutorily entitled to under the statute.
Why doesn't it matter that he didn't make a record that I had to use my peremptory on so-and-so and I would have used it on this other person, and the type of record you would have to use to show that he was somehow harmed? Because the statute itself doesn't give the relief that you're seeking. And so we have to find some basis that he was denied some process to get the relief that you're seeking.
I actually think that somehow this case got cast wrong, and I want to use this oral argument to sort of try to recast it. What happened here really was a challenge for cause. Under the statute, provision 1866C, you can always make a for cause challenge during the voir dire. Counsel stood up, it was during the for cause challenges when this occurred, and said, juror 48 is disqualified by the statute. And the judge said, I don't think so, he's not real law enforcement. At that point, the issue was preserved. If a judge denies a for cause challenge based upon a misreading of the law, not a for favor challenge based upon the gray area of whether or not a particular juror may be biased, because those are discretionary issues. But if the judge makes a legal error and refuses to comply with the statute, at that point, in my view, the harm is complete. Now, in fact, and as well, and I think that everybody in this courtroom knew it was going to happen, The defense did use a peremptory to remove Juror 48, and that could be expected because, first of all, he was disqualified, and the government has conceded that. And second of all, members of law enforcement are usually, if they get, well, they're not supposed to be sitting on the jury at all, but even their family members are challenged for cause in situations.
What case says that failure to, an error in law on for cause means that you get a reversal rather than analysis of whether or not the person actually sat and whether they had, whether they showed that they were harmed? What case says that?
I don't think that they're, I have to draw analogies. First of all, before the Martin Salazar case, which dealt with for bias challenges for cause, there was a split in the circuits, and it was assumed it was a structural error if the judge made a mistake in for cause, because it is so incredibly difficult to show what you would have done if you weren't forced to use a particular peremptory. We do know in this case all the peremptories were exercised, and we do know that the peremptory was exercised by the defense, so I think the harm is on its face. But there's another line of cases. It goes back to the 80s, a Supreme Court case, McDonough v. Greenwood, which dealt with what do you do when a juror lies and conceals information, and then you find out afterwards that he was concealing information that might give you grounds for cause challenge. And the Supreme Court said, well, it's not an automatic reversal, but you do get a new trial if the juror concealed it. We don't have that issue here. And if it would have given you a for cause challenge if you knew it. So the assumption underlying those that line of cases, which has been followed through in criminal cases for the last 30 years, is that if you are have an absolute for cause challenge, which a statutory disqualification or exemption is, you get a new trial. It's an error of law. You did in this case, Mr. Ross Bottom's counsel did what it had to do. It brought to the court's attention the statutory exemption. It brought it timely to the court's attention. And then it was forced to exercise the peremptory. And if
so
it's not,
so you believe that the lawyer did not have the responsibility at all to say, and I used my peremptory on him instead of on juror X, and we are stuck with juror X, and I would have used it on him because of this reason, and
no,
you
I don't
believe that there, you need to go through that exercise at all?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and I think it would be somewhat an artificial exercise. You know, the exercise of peremptories is a very complex and delicate process, and I think it might not actually really work that way. It may be that everybody who was the two defense counsel and everybody who was working on jury selection here said, well, we have to get rid of Juror 48. He's law enforcement. But they didn't then say, well, you know,
right, but
this
you normally
guy,
do. In any kind of these other challenges, you do have to go back and say, and I was harmed because I would have done something differently. In other contexts, with your selection,
I'm going to take the position that no, when you exercise the challenge for cause for somebody who is legally exempt from sitting on your jury, you have established harm if the court makes an error.
Let me direct you back to the statute. Congress created a right to litigants in this situation, by providing them basically a preemptive right of new trial, essentially, a noncompliance. but the price for that was strict compliance with the statute. Now, that in the selection of juries, and everybody sitting up here has been a trial judge. Now, I sat for 7 years picking juries in the federal court and then a trial lawyer for that. To let to do anything other than strictly comply with this statute really really disregards the trade-off, the argument goes, of that Congress made. Without the statute, you would have to be arguing prejudice. And what you get is you don't have to argue prejudice. It doesn't matter if it's the technical violation or whatever. You don't have to demonstrate this had anything to do with anything. You get a walk. A lengthy, complicated trial. But you can't say the argument goes, and we've said that. You can't, you got to strictly comply with the statute or you don't get the benefit. Now,
I have two answers to that, Your Honor. First, I think that the defense did comply with the statute because this was, as they say, a for-cause challenge. And 1866C, and I ask Your Honors to look at that provision, says for-cause challenges can be exercised during voir dire. The provision that the government relied in an abundance of caution, this defense counsel prepared a written motion with a sworn statement. I don't actually think that that was even necessary because the for-cause challenge preserved the issue. The government says you have to do this beforehand. In the, I think it's the Kennedy case, this court recognized that there may be particular circumstances where it is simply not reasonable to expect something to be done before voir dire. And I think these are those...
The Kennedy case said you didn't comply with 1867D.
It's true. That defendant did not. But it did recognize there may be exceptions. And I would like to explain, if I may, why I think this case falls within that exception. What did the defense know before this juror walked in the courtroom? The defense did not have the jury disqualification form where this juror swore under oath that he was a full-time member of a police department. What the defense had was 100 or so jury questionnaires for all the jurors who had filed into the courtroom on Friday. The defense also knew that the court was only going to summon about 50 jurors to the courtroom. So there was a 50% chance that this particular juror wasn't even going to make it to the courtroom, let alone that the district court, when he made his for-cause challenge,
Let me take you back to what happened in this case. When did you file your sworn statement in the trial? Well, you weren't at trial.
No, I wasn't trial counsel.
Well, 7 days, when did you file that?
The defense counsel filed it within the, and I'm sorry, I'm going to say, I don't know if it's 5 or 7 days within the time when the information came to its attention. It's possible they misread the statute because, the statute, if you're talking about.
Well, it was 7 days after voir dire, so at that point, the jury was in the box?
At that point, the trial was over.
I'm sorry?
At that point, when they filed the motion, the jury was over, but they had made the for-cause challenge during the voir dire, at the first instance they could.
What I'm saying, though, is that at the time you filed your sworn statement, at the statute, attempting, I guess, to comply with the statute, did you have a verdict at that point?
The record doesn't reflect my understanding. It was filed before the jury verdict. It was filed that day the jury came down with its verdict.
Well, the one thing is clear. The jury had been sworn, right?
Yes, the jury was sworn.
So jeopardy had attached.
Jeopardy had attached.
So what you do is you delay, then jeopardy attaches, and then you not only do you get a new trial, you walk.
But he didn't delay. He made the for-cause challenge during voir dire, and it's sort of shifting the response.
That's not what the statute says, though, is it?
No, the statute does say. 1866C says you can make a for-cause challenge during voir dire. And this was a for-cause challenge.
And then the sworn statement provision doesn't apply.
I think that's intended to apply to a whole different set of circumstances.
You don't cite any case that says what you're saying.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
You don't cite any case that says what you're saying.
There are no cases involving
judges. There's a good reason why there's no cases saying that. And the government takes the position you didn't comply, not you personally, but there wasn't strict compliance with the statute in terms of when this was raised. And you said, that's why I was looking in the brief, the government conceded that, the government concedes he was disqualified. I didn't remember reading that. I'm looking in the red brief here. I don't see the government conceded anything about, A, the disqualification, but they vigorously argued noncompliance with the statute. So what am I misreading?
No, they have. I don't have the page in front of me, and you can ask Ms. Griffin. They did concede that this juror was not qualified for the purposes of appeal, that Juror 48 could not sit on the jury because he was a member of the police department. What they argue is that we were too late. And I submit again that when you make a for cause challenge, this section 1867 they rely on was intended to deal with an entirely different set of circumstances.
If so you're not relying
my
on
red
that
light 18, is on. So.
You're not relying on the 1867 like the brief or like the government. You're relying on 1866.
Yes, this
and that's what your whole thing is, that you believe that 1866C gives you the same relief that the other portion of the statute would give.
Yes, because I think 1867 was supposed to deal with sort of omnibus challenges to the process used in jury selection.
And you can't comply with 1867. You didn't.
Can I say, well, I know my red light is on, but I'd like to say one thing. This court decided a case, it's called Evans, and the government relies on it. And in Evans, the clerk made the same error that was made here and put and allowed exempt policemen, servicemen, and firemen to sit on the jury wheel. And somehow the defendant in that case found out before voir dire and made a motion to dismiss the indictment. There's no indication that any of those exempt persons made it onto a jury veneer or that the court would have allowed them to sit. But this court said at that point, you couldn't move to dismiss the indictment. It was just a clerk's error. If they had made that motion Friday afternoon, I believe it would have been frivolous and premature. Under Evans, it would have to be denied. And then, if you're saying the for cause motion, the for cause challenge is not enough, there's really no remedy for the defendant. The burden for enforcing the statute is shifted to the defendant's shoulders to either exercise a peremptory or go with an unqualified jury.
All right, Ms. Tableson, we have your opening argument. You've preserved,
thank you very much.
You've reserved time for rebuttal. All right, Ms. Hudson.
May it please the court. In the time I've reserved, I'm going to talk a little bit about the issues that both counsel have raised with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence. And I'd like to begin with the issue of the insufficiency of the evidence to support the money laundering counts that both defendants were convicted of, which was a conspiracy count, not the underlying substantive count. In that regard, we're talking about a number of cashier's checks that were made out to Mr. Rossbottom, some many, many months before the June 9th, 2009 filing of the bankruptcy, which, of course, was his personal filing, had nothing to do with the businesses or Ms. Kisla. And those cashier's checks made out to him is what, in essence, the government says was concealed assets that formed the basis for the bankruptcy fraud, and that Ms. Kisla was a part of that conspiracy. Even though it wasn't her specific bankruptcy, and there's no evidence that she was involved in the orders to form these various cashier's checks made out to him at per instructions to employees of Rossbottom. But in any event, even if you accept that that is a bankruptcy fraud or there is a conspiracy there based upon the concealment of those cashier's checks, the issue then becomes is whether the use of those cashier's checks to buy a boat and to buy a plane constitute money laundering as opposed to what we believe it is, money spending. As this court knows, in the DeMitt case, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, following QLR and applying QLR to the circumstances of financial transactions, for purposes of concealment money laundering, you have to establish that the purpose, even if the impact or effect of the transaction is to conceal, that the purpose is to conceal. And in that regard, and I'm already running out of time, I'll get cut to the chase. The evidence is that in fact, I mean, there's no cash used. Employees were used to conduct these transactions. They were part of banks. Everything was in Rossbottom's name or ultimately placed in Ms. Kisla's name. There is testimony from Mr. Levering as to why the plane was bought and the circumstances and why it was put in Kisla's name. Ultimately, he bought them out and he didn't pay Kisla or Westwind. He paid Nitro Gaming for the percentage, that half of the plane. With respect to the boat, Mr. Rossbottom's son was there. It was a very public event. It was not, in fact, designed to conceal the bankruptcy fraud proceeds. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. All right, we're here from the government. Mr. Griffin.
May it please the court, my name is Mignon Griffin and I represent the appellee. I would like to start with the money laundering count. Your Honors, the government charged both promotion and concealment money laundering. The defense claims that we waived the promotion argument. I disagree. I've stated that in my brief. However, I think we win even under the concealment prong because I think it's clear that the purpose in converting $1.8 million worth of cashier's checks into assets owned by a company owned by Ms. Kistler was to conceal them from the trustee and the creditors. This court has said that the hallmarks of an intent to conceal are the use of third parties, the use of false names, and complicated and unnecessary financial transactions. If your honors will review the transactions in this case, the FBI agent did a chart which shows how the money flowed. I believe it's governments 58, or 57, 58, and 59. You can see that there are a number of times where the money is deposited into one account, immediately wired to a different account, immediately wired to a different account. Cashier's checks are converted from one large cashier's check into smaller cashier's checks. It's just a lot of unnecessary transactions run unnecessarily through different companies. For example, to buy the plane, and Mr. Levering testified that this was not just putting the plane in Ms. Kistler's name was not just something that was done for him as a favor. Mr. Rossbottom was actually buying a 1/2 interest in the plane. And on the day that that was done, four cashier's checks were deposited into two different accounts captioned Ohio River Amusements tax sweep account and just a regular Ohio River Amusement account. The money was then wired from those two accounts to a Homa Inn account, and then it was transferred to the bank to pay for the plane. So there was no point in those cashier's checks being deposited and then wired here and wired there. And it's clear that there was an intent to conceal in those transactions. I would like now to go to the juror issue. Your Honor, I agree with you. I did not concede that he was covered under the statute. I just assumed for purposes of my argument that he was because I thought that we won whether he was or not. But I think that Judge Walter, first of all, Mr. Stroud's objection was clearly directed at the Jury Selection and Service Act. He was not making a challenge for cause. He never alleged that the juror was biased in any way. He simply cited to what he claimed was a new statute provides that law enforcement members cannot serve on a jury.
But he doesn't have to say that the juror is individually biased to make a for-cause challenge.
Every for-cause challenge I've ever made, Your Honor, I had to cite a reason why I thought they were biased.
Well, the reason would be that the juror is statutorily ineligible, therefore, for-cause, there's a for-cause basis to strike.
I guess, Your Honor, I'm trying to say that he was exempt. He wasn't biased. He was exempt, and therefore Mr. Stroud had to comply with the Jury Selection and Service Act requirements that Judge Higginbotham was referring to. In order to object to him, he had to file the written motion and the affidavit, and that was not done until after the...
don't you think that the judge should have responded to a foreclosure when the judge says there's a statutory ineligible person, when they say, that person's ineligible, I make a for-cause challenge because there is cause for this juror not to serve. The judge can't say, well, you're really making a statutory objection, you're not making a for-cause. The judge at that point has a responsibility to strike the juror for cause.
Your Honor, the judge was applying the law as he understood it, and his understanding was that a reserve deputy whose full-time job was working employee at a police supply business was not covered by that statute.
Right, but if the judge determines that they are covered by the statute, then they have to, at that point, dismiss them, strike them for cause.
Your Honor, if he had said that he was a full-time Bossier City Marshal, then I agree he should have been stricken for cause.
And
or
you
that
could
he should
just
have
make an objection to and say, that judge is ineligible, Your Honor. They're full-time law enforcement or whatever reason. They're a judge. They can't serve. Then the judge has the responsibility at that point, right?
I think if he knew that he was a full-time law enforcement, he should have stricken him. Yes, ma'am. But in this case, what the judge knew from, and what the defense attorneys knew, both from the questionnaires that were given to counsel on the Friday before and from the questioning under oath of the juror in court, was that he was a full-time employee at Tico Safety, which is a police supply business in Shreveport, and that he also worked as a reserve deputy marshal. And the judge said that it was his understanding that, or that it was his belief that a reserve officer wasn't covered. The judge was not cavalier about this. They broke for approximately 45 minutes, I believe the record reflects, and then the judge came back out and he said, upon further reflection, I still believe that I ruled correctly and I do not believe this juror is covered. The judge's determination, I would submit, is correct under the Scott case, where this court said that the purpose behind excusing law enforcement, police officers, military members, is that it's best for the community if they are about their regular job and are not tied up in jury duty.
Did you argue this in your brief to us?
Yes, ma'am.
That they were correct?
Oh, no, ma'am.
No, you didn't make this argument in your brief to us.
No.
This is something you're kind of, it's your fallback that you're relying on now. It wasn't briefed. You assumed arguendo that the juror was not qualified.
I did, but I just wanted to say, and I didn't intend to spend a lot of time on it, that I did think that the judge was correct. But regardless, his interpretation was reasonable. He was applying the objective standard set out in the statute. The statute, as this court has recognized many times, the purpose of the statute was to eliminate subjective criteria in the determination of juries. The statute's purpose is to ensure randomly selected jurors whose members are picked with objective criteria.
Right, but in the analysis you just went through where the judge would say, well, I don't think that the part-time nature or that he has another job, that's exactly the kind of subjective analysis that the statute's designed to omit by having a bright-line rule for law enforcement, isn't it?
No, ma'am, because it's clear in the case law that the types of subjective criteria that this court was trying to get rid of, that Congress was trying to eliminate, were things like good character, which were extra criteria that were grafted on to jury selection and that resulted in discrimination and non-random juries.
So is it the government's position that this juror was statutorily eligible to serve or not?
I think that the judge's determination was reasonable, but I did assume...
I'm not asking for discretion or reasonableness or arbitrary and capricious. I'm asking for, as a matter of law, was this juror eligible to serve?
I think he was. I assumed otherwise from my brief because I didn't think it mattered, but I think he was. Because under the Scott case, his full-time job was working in a police supply store, not being a law enforcement officer. Therefore, the community did not benefit from his exemption.
How long did it take to try this case?
It was a 5-day case, Your Honor. 5 days, yes, sir. The verdict came back on Friday. And it's my understanding that the verdict...
Was the trial over when the affidavit filed or not?
It's my understanding that it was, Your Honor.
Sorry?
It's my understanding that it was, that the document was filed around 10 p.m. at night and the verdict had been returned earlier that evening. Unfortunately, the docket sheet doesn't reflect times, but that's my understanding from the filing documents themselves. But this court has said that when a district judge is applying these objective criteria, and I submit, Your Honor, they're not that bright line. I mean, law enforcement officer, does that cover an FBI agent? Well, it doesn't. It says state and local law enforcement. I apologize. That's not a good example. But it's not clearly a bright line. A lot of people in Louisiana are buddies with the sheriff, and the sheriff gives them a badge that they can carry around, and they call themselves deputies. What's the statute intended to cover
that?
Can
the government get a new trial application under this stuff? Same facts, except that the government's the one that doesn't want the juror?
No, I don't believe the government would have gotten a new trial either. The government didn't object.
Assuming that... But applying the law as the defendant here would have us do, but change the facts, and it's the government that wants out, you got an acquittal, and can you get a new trial?
Well, clearly, if there's an acquittal, Your Honor, the government would be barred from seeking a new trial.
Is it a one-way street?
I have found that to be the case in much of my criminal law practice, Your Honor.
If this case is, if they prevail, they will go back for a new trial. Is that correct?
Your Honor, that's actually not, I don't believe that's correct, because under the statute, the remedy is a delay in the trial to allow for the selection of an appropriately constituted jury.
The drift of my question is, the whole purpose of this statute is to prevent exactly this from happening.
Yes, sir.
So, because the remedy that it contemplates is to stop the proceedings at that juncture, not to go forward. Because once you swear the jury, jeopardy attaches, ordinarily. And then the question of whether their jeopardy is a bar or not turns on the characterization of the error, et cetera. That is, that there's some types of, I can envision situations where it just gives you a new trial.
Yes, Your Honor. And this court has said that the only remedy for a Pettit jury is, and the statute says, the only remedy when we're talking about a Pettit jury is a delay in the proceedings to allow for the selection of a properly constituted jury without the exempt juror.
If you stop the trial in the course of the trial, you could stop the trial and start over if the defendant's asking for that, correct?
And I would assume that you could just strike that individual juror and move an alternate into his place. This would be another option. I believe in this case, one of the jurors late in the proceeding announced that he did, in fact, know one of the witnesses. He didn't recognize the name, but he recognized the face. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I backed off of the microphone. I apologize. In this case, there was an instance where one of the jurors late into the trial said that he knew one of the witnesses. He had not recognized the name, but he had recognized the face, and that was simply resolved by removing him from the panel and replacing him with an alternate. And I believe that that's what could have been done here. But Judge Walter never had a chance to do that because the defendant didn't comply with the provisions of the statute. And Your Honor, the harmless error analysis is built into the statute. It says clearly that it's only a substantial failure to comply with the act that gets you relief, and it recognizes that judges are on occasion going to make errors when they apply the subjective criteria.
I'm confused. Why did the judge not have an opportunity to remove the juror? The judge knew at the voir dire that the juror was. So it's not the same as the witness, the juror who knew the witness in the middle of trial, and my goodness, should be removed. It's not analogous, because the problem was alerted to the judge during the voir dire.
Yes, ma'am, you're correct. Yes, Your Honor, you're correct. And in this case, the judge did make a determination that he thought that the juror was not covered by that statute, and because of his reserve status and his full-time employment at the police supply business.
When did counsel at this trial obtain the questionnaire?
The first set of questionnaires that were included in the original trial record were obtained on Friday. Jury selection began on Monday.
Speak more slowly, if you would, please.
I apologize, Your Honor. The questionnaires went to counsel on Friday. Jury selection started the following Monday.
So all 75 went to counsel on Friday?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then was the information and the material they got on Friday available? Was it the same information that they later made them objected on the basis of?
Your Honor, they did not know anything more.
I thought there was more information came after the first 75.
Your Honor, all of the written juror questionnaires went to the defense and government on Friday.
Right.
And then there was the oral voir dire on Monday.
Right.
And both times.
That's pretty much standard procedure.
Yes, sir. And then during the course of the appeal, the defense asked for and received copies of the pre-selection, I don't know the exact term, I apologize, but the questionnaires that the potential jurors fill out.
What was on the 70, what did this particular juror answer he was in the 75, what was his answer on those? Or what information did he say about his law enforcement work?
He said his employer was TECO Safety, his type of work was police sales, and his other occupation was a reserve deputy marshal.
And what hired did the record show where he was in the panel? Was he examined individually?
He was examined individually, Your Honor. He said that
defense counsel or prosecutor or both?
Judge Hick. I'm sorry. He was not taken into the back and examined.
What?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. He was not taken aside and examined individually.
Addressed individually. You have a panel sitting out there, and then judge is going to talk to them, and then sometimes they have different practices, but sometimes then the DA will get to see it, gets to ask questions of the defense counsel.
I don't know in this case if Judge Walter allowed questioning by the parties, but Judge Walter elicited from him that he was employed at TECO Safety. The record incorrectly says PECO Safety, but it's TECO Safety. And when the judge asked the question, have you ever served as a law enforcement officer, he said yes, and said he was then currently a reserve deputy marshal for the Bossier City Marshal's Office. The questionnaire, so the defendants had everything.
So that then, it was more than 7 days before the affidavit was filed after that.
It was 5 days later, Your Honor. But
it's 5 days.
But the statute says voir dire or this 7 days, whichever occurs first. In this case, the defendants did not know any more Friday when they filed than they knew Monday. They could clearly have timely filed it. And the documents that they obtained from the clerk on appeal don't really add anything else to the equation, because they both also say that he worked primarily in police sales for TECO Safety and then was also a reserve marshal.
Did Judge Walter's querying of the potential juror include, you know, when he said, I'm a reserve deputy marshal, were there follow-up questions like, you know, what does that involve? You know, when do you serve? Where do you go? I mean, anything that extracted more information than the status?
No, Your Honor. He just asked him, would that bias his judgment in the case in any way? And the juror responded.
The defense asked the judge to explore this further based on what they had the Friday preceding the...
No, Your Honor. Not that I'm aware of. Not that's reflected in the record that I saw.
Could you address the idea that if they would have written out their motion on Friday night when they got home, that whether it would have been seen as premature, can you address that?
I don't believe it would have been premature, Your Honor. I think that once the facts were presented to them from which they could have known, or the statute even says, I'm sorry, which they did know, and the statute even says could have known, it is their obligation. This is not a self-enforcing statute, as this court has said.
What about the Evans case? What do we do with that?
I did not read the Evans case in the same way that Ms. Adelson did, Your Honor. The main thing that's important out of Evans to me is that it was a mere technical violation that law enforcement were inadvertently or incorrectly, rather, qualified to sit on the jury.
Okay. So if they would have filed this on Friday night, you believe the judge would have ruled the same way that he ruled at the voir dire, then they would have been entitled to their new trial?
I still think the judge would have just been making a technical violation in applying the objective criteria, so no, ma'am, I do not believe they would have been entitled to a new trial.
Well, how do we know what the judge would have done when they didn't do it?
And the obligation is on them, Your Honor.
What difference does that make? Well, if there is a difference, I'm just missing it.
Yes. I don't see that it does make a difference, Your Honor. Your Honor, and the bottom line is the defendants in this case were tried by a qualified and impartial jury. They received a fair trial, and the government submits that they are not entitled to relief. And if this court has no further questions.
Okay, refresh my memory. What's the essence of the affidavit?
Sufficient facts which would prove a violation of the act.
No. I mean, what's the essence of the affidavit concerning this juror? The affidavit, which was later filed, what's the essence of it? I mean, what does it say more than?
It doesn't say anything more than he was a law enforcement officer for the Bossier City Marshal's Office and therefore wasn't qualified to serve.
Okay, so when the preliminary one that the judge has and all that screening still doesn't have any more information on it than what came out otherwise, is that correct?
No, Your Honor, there was nothing additional added.
Okay. I just want to make sure it's clear.
If there are no further questions, I cede back the balance of my time.
All right. We're back to you, counsel.
I'd like to make a few points that I think will correct some of the things that were said. First of all, the statute does not require that the police officer be full-time. The statute says the jury plan shall specify that the following persons are barred from jury service on the ground they are exempt: members of the fire or police departments of any state, the District of Columbia, any territory or possession of the United States, any subdivision of a state, blah, 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 a few other categories. This full-time, this is, I think this is a non-issue. I mean, I don't know exactly what full-time even is.
Well, let me follow up on that. If it's not a full, what, I don't quite follow the drift of that argument. That's what you're saying is that you had a full statutory violation based on what information was given to you on Friday.
What information was given to us on Friday, that he was a reserve deputy marshal, I think probably disqualified him from the jury. Our position is that it would have been premature. We did not know that we got 100 questionnaires, and we did not know if he was going to be one of the 50. And certainly, I don't think the defense could assume that when it raised a statutory disqualification for cause during voir dire, that the judge would shoot from the hip and say, I don't think he's full time. And the government sort of retreating.
Are you saying that the information that was on the questionnaire that you got on Friday, I thought your opening statement just here was that in and of itself is a violation, because it doesn't matter what it was. And if that's true, then I don't see how in the world you can make it.
I'm not saying that exactly, Your Honor, because when you put down other occupation, reserve deputy marshal, it can mean a lot of things. But when it became absolutely clear that this juror was exempt was during the voir dire, when he raised his hand and the judge asked the question, does anybody here serve on law enforcement?
Well, how does that translate to more information? I mean, I've asked and I haven't heard yet that there's any more information at any step here than the disclosure reserve deputy marshal.
Because it
is
became
that correct or not?
No. Well, although there was the jury disqualification form where this jurist, which we didn't have, the court did have, where he swore under oath, and there are penalties for violating that oath, that he was a full-time member of a police department.
Well, he never says full-time.
It does on the form. It does, and I don't think the form is actually in compliance with the statute, but the form does say full-time, and he swore it under oath at that point. We did not have that. What I think the judge should have done is what this court demanded the judges do.
What I'm asking you is, the forms on Friday say reserve deputy marshal. If your position is that, per se, you know, that's the magic information that gives rise. The statute says before the voir dire exam begins. And all I've asked is, at what point was more information disclosed about the status? And what I've heard is that he said he was a reserve deputy marshal, that none of the forms say more than that. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor, the disqualification form, which the court had, but the defendant did not, said he was a full-time member of the employer. But what our position...
What did it say? What more did it say?
It said, I am a full-time member of a police department on the jury disqualification form. That form we did not have, the court had. But it's our position that the obligation to determine whether this man was exempt was on the district court's shoulders. It's the district court's obligation to enforce the statute. In the Beckner case, this court said when you're...
The obligation to file the affidavit is on your shoulder.
And the defense did file the affidavit, and it did make its cause, but the obligation to...
And that's the reason it strictly complied is that you want to challenge the judge for not doing it, and you're not there insisting it. It's to prevent sandbagging.
I'd like to make a hypothetical and ask and say, what if we're in the courtroom? You didn't have the jury did not fill out the information form exactly correctly. Okay, so you're in the courtroom, and the judge asks, "Is anybody here not a citizen?" Juror one raises his hand. The judge says, anybody here not a resident of the district? Juror one raises his hand. May I have permission to finish?
Well, that depends. You into a hypothet. I know I'm pretty flexible on continuing the sentence, but I don't know how far I'm going to be on a hypothet. I think I'm going to let you make the point you want to make succinctly, but without stretching the hypothet.
Well, what would happen if the defense made a disqualification for cause challenge then? According to the government, it would be too late. He had to make it beforehand, and he had to make it if he had this qualification. And the district court could stand there and blatantly violate the statute. The government...
We're not really dealing with the what ifs. You know, we're trying to get to where we are. I mean, we hear your argument. You've got it in brief. We look at the forms, and we now know the timing and so forth. You're arguing virtually a per se violation, but that's the reason why we have oral argument. So we can get a clear understanding of what the position's taken here. I still don't see the government's conceded anything. That doesn't mean anything.
Can I just read?
Nope, you can't.
Okay. Well, then I won't.
Make the point. You've got it all in brief. There are a whole bunch of other issues in this case, but for reasons, I guess, that are obvious, you've used your time on the jury selection one rather than the other. But that notwithstanding, we've got the whole case, and we'll go through all the issues that have been briefed and submitted to us in the case. We thank all
thank
counsel
you
for your able advocacy, and this case will be submitted. All right, we'll call the next case.